Hey folks, welcome into On to Wavelength, presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. I am Brett Taylor, joined by Sahadev Sharma and Patrick Mooney. This is it's the Cubs podcast here at The Athletic, which means we get to talk about the fact that the Cubs are up 1-0 in the World Series after one batter. The Cubs get credit for that, right?
Yeah. Well, they're the last, everybody's saying this is the first time a player has led off a World Series game with a home run, and I think Cubs fans know that's not true. I think it's led off game one of the World Series. People are leaving that.
Yeah,
little,
he's the first to lead off the World Series.
The World
Series. Full
stop,
with a home run.
Yeah.
But I did love, that was a great excuse to be reminded, to be pedantic and remind people that no, actually, that did happen 5 years ago. Of course, Dexter Fowler in Game 7, 2016. With his spin pirouette at first base. Oh, I still get chills just thinking about it. But otherwise,
I barely remember the spin pirouette, but I do remember thinking, I do remember having some concern that, oh no, is that going to be the Cubs version of Devin Hester returning the kickoff for a touchdown?
Oh man. You know, it is funny. Not that we're not going to turn this into a Game 7 podcast 5 years later, but what's funny is, of course, we Cubs fans watching it all felt the panic as the game got tight late. And certainly the Rajai Davis home run. And I mean, all of that, of course, we had obvious feelings about that. But I got to tell you, for seven innings after the Fowler home run, I and everyone I was with, Cubs fans I've talked to later about it, we all felt like, oh, wow, this is in hand. They're really going to do this. And that's such a weird way to be for a Cubs fan in that moment, to not feel like, wow, the rug is going to get pulled out from under us. And it, even after the Davis home run, I wasn't feeling like, wow, this is how it ends. I was like, oh crap, this is tied. I'm really nervous again. And so I was just reflecting on that. It's interesting that I would have thought that after 108 years, you would have thought, okay, how is this going to fall apart? But I never had that throughout that whole game. I was just sort of like, oh man, you know, David Ross hits the home run, Javi hits the home run. It's like, dude, they're doing this.
It's going to immediately fall apart right after they win the World Series.
That's right. That's what
dynasty you're expecting, just going to go poof. Don't worry.
That's where the naivete was. It wasn't in not immediately thinking this is going to fall apart in the game. It was in not realizing it was going to fall apart after the game. Society in general, everything, not just the Cubs dynasty.
The following Tuesday, things will all be really wild.
I didn't specify anything in particular, Mr. Mooney. I could be talking about anything. So anyway, the 2021 edition of the World Series is underway. Like I said, the Braves taking game one, Jorge Soler hit that leadoff home run and they didn't look back from there. Certainly I think most Astros and Braves agnostic fans are probably pulling for the Braves in this one, not wanting to see the Astros get some kind of redemption tour, after the 2017 win and the cheating scandal. But at the same time, I do see the kind of a groundswell of people kind of thinking, oh, you know what? It'd be nice for Dusty to get this one. That would be nice. And I think you don't see that so much in Cubs corners, because I don't think there's a lot of love lost for Dusty's time with the Cubs, fair or unfair. I think he's regarded among Cubs fans as the guy who was there when they deeply disappointed. And I think that has stuck with Cubs fans even 20 years later with Dusty. But do you guys have any thoughts on what you want to see out of this World Series? You know, just as baseball fans, baseball writers, what's the storyline stuff for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit the storyline with Dusty there. I mean, that's, and I actually have had some friends text me like, do I root for Dusty or do I root do I root against the Astros because they're the cheaters? They're not as embedded in the baseball universe as us, of course. I think that's interesting that just the average fan is thinking that, and at least that I've, anecdotal evidence that I have. Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, Brett, about Dusty. Fans, I've noticed fans don't, like Cubs fans don't appreciate him. You talk to Cubs media that was around during the Dusty era, all of them have nothing but good things to say about Dusty, right? Like, they all loved covering Dusty. They believe he gets a bad rap in Chicago for the most part. He probably does. You know, I was a fan back then, so it's hard for me to really look at it objectively. I see it as like, hey, maybe Dusty could have gone and talked to his pitcher when Moises Alou was throwing a tantrum out in left field. But
or not let Mark Pryor throw 130 freaking pitches in a blowout earlier in the series.
Yes, we could relitigate all of 2003 and get all stressed out once again. I know I was back then. But Dusty seems like a good dude in the general scheme of the baseball world, but I don't know him well enough to really comment on that strongly. I'm rooting for Atlanta, even with the racist chants that they have in their stadium. And that always throws me off.
Did you see?
And it's funny because
Rob Manfred's comments about that, by the way.
Yeah,
I feel like I had to have. So, go read about it, folks. They're up at The Athletic if you want to read them. But like, I felt like I had to have misunderstood what he was trying to say. If I did, everybody did, because everybody was like, "Wait, what? It's a regional sport, and therefore we have to honor the chop because they have to sell tickets in Atlanta. What exactly are you trying to say?" Like, it was very bizarre.
He's just saying, like, I don't want to deal with this. I did the Cleveland thing, people. Isn't that enough for you? The name Braves isn't as racist. It's the chop. The chop is so obviously racist. It's just like, to me, it's just like, Who had a tweet about it? Oh, Bomani Jones, I think, is a Braves fan, and he said, like, he was like 11. I think he's like the same age as me. He remembers in like 91 how he thought the chop was so cool when he was 11 years old, and I did too. I was like, oh, look at that! All these fans together doing this, and that's kind of a cool. It sounds cool, and it looks like they're all harmonious. It's like that's awesome. Like, that's got to be awesome to see. And now I look back and I'm like, oh man, I was an idiot. Like, that's super racist. Like, I do not want my kid thinking that's cool. My kid like looks at it like the first time he heard it, he's like, wait, what's going on? What are they doing? Wait, what? They're doing that? That is not appropriate.
That should be the answer to everyone who wonders, like, you know, is it acceptable? Is it not? Imagine yourself explaining what they're doing and why they're doing it to a kid. Go through that.
Yeah.
And then you'll realize, oh, wait, this is really patronizing and bad and not. Yeah. I felt I don't want to. We don't have to linger on that as well. But I did think his remarks on that were odd.
It was very on point for Rob Manfred, though, because the thing I didn't understand, too, I mean, he moved the All-Star game out of Atlanta in recognition that there's a society there that has multiple points of view and does not come towards a single issue with like a monolithic opinion. And I thought there were like a million other ways you could have answered it. And yeah, like, not to linger on, I do think the chant is what, you know, I think we all kind of grew up around the same time, remembering the Braves kind of coming out of nowhere, and they're this like cool team. Deion Sanders, the Hall of Fame pitchers, like all of it, like they were the team. And you just heard the chant, you had at that point in your life, they had no idea. And I remember the Cubs were in Atlanta, I want to say maybe 2019, like the second series of the year. And like my first time at that new park, and they start doing the chant, like it's like the fourth game of the season, fifth game of the season. And I'm like, really? In 2019, like we're still doing this? Like this isn't like 1991, like World Series playoff type game. Like this still goes on in their publicly funded stadium on the outskirts of the Atlanta exurbs. Like, I don't know. But
well, and just a final thought of that, it is not to be forgotten that it was two postseasons ago that is Adam Halsey, was that his name, pitcher for the Cardinals, who has Native American heritage, who himself said, hey, that ain't cool. Maybe don't do that. And so the Braves tried to sort of downplay it at a ballpark level for that series. And then nothing. I don't know. So anyway, we'll I guess touch on that at some point in the future. So World Series talk aside, it is always this time of year when we have movement in the managerial ranks, the coaching ranks, and the front office. And you know that it's always this time of year, both by virtue of the calendar, but because we always have this topic of like, oh, can they announce something today? Can they not? Is it a game day in the postseason? What's frowned upon? What's officially prohibited? So I always think about it this time of year, particularly if your team is not participating in the postseason. And obviously the Cubs have had an active front office postseason already, number of changes on the incoming and outgoing side. And I thought it worth not only documenting those for the podcast listeners who may not have read about that stuff otherwise, but also you guys have been so thorough in your coverage of the front office transitions already that I thought it worth giving you guys an opportunity to talk about where we think the impact will be. And we've talked about new GM Carter Hawkins a bit, but he is not the only new name coming in. And also there are some transitions out. So kick that off, gents, wherever you want to touch on.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I'd say that I think the outside world underrates a steadying presence like Randy Bush. You know, I believe a 2-time World Series winner, like having an ex-Major League ball player in the front office is helpful. He's thoughtful. He's the type of guy that kind of brings people together, and he's very easy to work with. And I mean, he lasted multiple, you know, front offices, right? And this is more just like him. He's ready to kind of reduce his role, stop coming into the office, go spend some time with family out in Florida, and still be part of the organization, but not as heavily involved and not having to be in the office as an assistant GM, right? So I just want to give Randy Bush his props, like one of the nicest guys I've ever met in baseball, and just a good guy, and obviously had contributed to multiple versions of winning Cubs baseball under Hendry, under Theo, and I guess not under Jed, because they didn't really win a lot under Jed yet.
No, he did. He contributed to the wins, and only the wins. It was a weird thing. Like, somebody should have noticed. When Randy's in the park, we do really well. Analytics should have pointed that out.
And stepping in as AGM is Essin Bakari, who, first of all, I wanted to make sure Cubs fans know that he arrived in Houston after the sign stealing.
I think that's definitely worth pointing out. In fact, indeed, he was with the Dodgers when they got screwed by the Astros in the 2017 World Series. So he's actually a victim of all of this.
So, I mean, first of all, the Dodgers, one of the best research and development departments in baseball, right? I mean, I think they're roundly considered that. He was part of the original group. He helped build that up. He was one of the first analysts, I think, whatever R&D analysts, whatever they're called, whatever that title is that he originally had with the Dodgers. He was there. He helped build that unit up. And then he came to lead R&D with the Astros when Mike Fast, who, if you don't know who Mike Fast is, he was hired by the Astros early on, I think in the Lanao era. And he was the guy, he kind of made a catcher framing mainstream. He kind of was the first public writer to kind of bring that to the forefront. And he left for Atlanta, I want to say. I think Mike Fast is with Atlanta, and Bakari took over in Houston, and then he got a promotion, and I wish I could remember the title. You think I'd remember it since I just wrote this, but basically he got a promotion in that front office. I've heard nothing but good things about him. This is a guy that has like an education background, right? He's a former professor. He was a visiting professor at University of Illinois. And you think R&D, first of all, you think guys, a lot of R&D guys aren't very talkative. They're not engaging. That's not the case with Bakari. Everything that I've heard about him, I'm 99% sure he's someone I met while I was while the Cubs were in Houston 2 years ago. And if he's the person I'm remembering, which I'm almost positive he is, he is engaging. Like for 5 minutes, he was very engaging and like very talkative and just very personable. And from the people I've talked to since the hiring, since I heard about the potential hiring and since it's been official, nothing but good things. This guy wants to know everything about front offices. He worked. He didn't just stick to R&D. He didn't just assume that, oh, model. The model says this. The model is right. We built this model. This is what it spit out. We're going with this. He wants to double check the processes. He wants to understand the processes that scouts are using, whether it's international, pro, amateur. He's dipped his toes in every little aspect of the front office, and he wants to be a more well-rounded front office member. And I mean, what, it's been 7-8 years since he got into baseball, and he's climbed up to assistant GM, going from like an education background to this is pretty impressive. Still a young guy. I think he's clearly got a bright future ahead of him. Brings two elite organizations. I mean, if you think about the two best organizations as far as success on the field, you want to, you know, rip the Astros for cheating. I get that. That's very legitimate. They've added so much talent to that organization and continue to produce talent. The Dodgers speak for themselves as well with the way they produce talent. We know Jed Hoyer thinks highly of the Dodgers. He wants to make the Cubs into the Dodgers. He wants to be able to spend, but also have financial flexibility. And then when you lose a player, you instantly can just produce another one like that guy that steps up. I mean, the fact that they had so many injuries and were still almost able to make it to the World Series this year speaks to the, you know, amount of talent that they're able to develop and put out there and the depth that they have. And that's what Jed Hoyer wants to build. I think that's going to be an interesting hire. I'm curious to see how that impacts the front office, how much say he has in transactions. I know that he did have a decent amount. I heard, I didn't get any specific names, but I was told that yeah, he had a hand in some significant transactions with the Astros, which that's interesting to know that he's already been a part of that, and I'm sure he'll have a similar hand with the Cubs.
And Brett, I was curious to get your take on Jason McLeod's impending exit. The guy who the lead to my story was, you know, he oversaw scouting and player development when the Cubs had the number one farm system and won the World Series, period. And I think over time, probably more unfair than not, he kind of had to wear the Cubs' struggles to develop homegrown pitchers, and that's part of the job. I also think that there were a lot of factors that went into that, stuff that we've talked about before, whether, you know, I think Theo Epstein's fingerprints were certainly on the Cubs kind of drafting manuals and procedures when they had a very kind of narrow view of pitchers and very conservative approach to the pitchers they selected, how they trained in the minors. I think McLeod repeatedly acknowledged those shortcomings and had, you know, begun with his staff as a whole to make some changes. And I think, you know, the 2018 and 2019 drafts might look pretty good if Brennan Davis and Nico Horner, Ryan Jensen, you know, DJ Hers, if they kind of pop and become part of that next great Cubs team. But ultimately, I think, you know, he did the job he was hired to do. I mean, they got the parade. That's kind of what you want. And, you know, he declined an offer to kind of an unspecified offer in terms of it, what he would actually be doing kind of in this reimagined front office. But I think your Cubs are losing a guy who, and this was something that was not apparent when he came in, because everyone talked about his evaluation skills and some of those drafts with the Red Sox. But I think where he really made a mark was some of the coordinators that they hired who became major league manager, major league coaches, kind of in demand instructors. Kind of this idea of when it happens, the way that everyone was kind of moving in one direction. I think he did a lot to that, and you know, he saw his draft picks, you know, make a ton of plays in the game seven in Cleveland.
Yeah, I think we have a tendency when it comes to front offices, and particularly name front offices, or a situation like we had at the start of the rebuild where it was, all right, Theo's coming. Oh man, he's bringing Jed. Oh man, and Jed is bringing this guy, Jason McLeod. I need to find out about him. And then, oh, they're really more of like a trio. And it ends up becoming this idea where everything that then occurs thereafter is ascribed to these men, good or bad. And I think that's, of course, unfair in large part because of what you mentioned, Mooney, that in the wake of their arrival, one of the things that the Cubs did organizationally that has, I think, and I will claim that I have failed on this too, that we didn't talk about enough in those first 5 years, is how good they were at developing minor league coaching and development talent. And right when they were getting to the peak of the farm system's prowess, the big league team succeeding, they got poached like crazy. I mean, it was just a total run. And of course, we reported on that and mentioned it, but I think in hindsight, it was probably, one, a huge credit to McLeod and to the others in charge that they brought in and cultivated that talent. And then it was probably very hard to sustain the success at the minor league level when you are losing four or five guys at the same time to various organizations. And I think it's no question, obviously, that the farm system, the development process, the transitions to the big league, the development at the big league level, all of these things suffered a great deal over the last 5 years. And they led in part to the underperformance of the big league team, Theo's early departure, the overhaul of the player development department a couple of years ago, Theo says at Jed Hoyer's behest, and whether, you know, however true that is or not, I know that we Cubs fans desperately want to believe that that's true, because then you can be forward looking and be like, ah, Jed really gets it. But all the while, Jason McLeod was there. And I think it became harder and harder to sort of single out, like, well, what is he responsible for? What can we say he gets credit for? What can we say he's cost the organization? Things like that. And it ends up sort of not mattering. I mean, I think we will always look at this era as one unit of a thing. And in that time, the Cubs selected a whole lot of great players. They developed a whole lot of great players. They went to three straight NLCS. They won a World Series largely on the strength of guys that they had drafted and developed. And I think that should stay. That should stay a credit to McLeod's contributions to this organization. He was here for a decade. And so I that's how I will think about it. And it will be impossible to separate the failures on the pitching development side. I think they came in clearly with a philosophy that kind of made sense on paper. You know, you sort of, you draft and try to develop a lot of really high floor arms, and you try to tease out a little bit more from them where your failure rate is going to be very low. You know, they're going to progress through the system. They're going to be strike throwers. And we've came to learn that, you know, injuries, of course, still happen. And then at the big league level, in the way the game developed over the last 6 or 7 years, those types just tend not to play. And you have to take bigger risks. You have to take bigger swings. You have to get guys that have the really elite risky arms and then try to tease out the floor. You can't do it the other way. And it took the Cubs a little too long to realize that. And the nature of development is that it is, you know, backlogged by several years. And so where we are now is we hope we are seeing the very start of that organizational philosophy change. I think it was in 2017 to 2018 is when they realized at a drafting and signing level, oh, we have to make some big changes. And, you know, it just takes a long time for that to bear fruit. So hopefully we will. And then maybe we'll look back and we'll say, like you did, Mooney, that, oh, well, and McLeod was a part of that for many years when the transition happened. It's just he's no longer here. So wherever he goes, he will continue to be a successful baseball mind because obviously he is good at a lot of what he does. He has had a lot of success in three different organizations, and I think he'll be remembered fondly by fans.
You know, and some things that fans may overlook, and obviously they're not going to know these things. They're not privy to this stuff. But when Patrick and I talk to people around baseball who have worked with Jason or worked under Jason, like, this is a great leader. This is someone who is highly respected by the people that work under him or work alongside him, in the sense that it's really hard to find people that communicate well, that are organized, that delegate well, that really earn the respect of the people that they're, you know, above. He works really well with the people below him and the people above him, if that makes sense. Like, he's really good at that, which is a hard skill, I swear. Like, it's rare in this business. When you talk to people, like, either they screw up some aspect of it. Either they think they're more powerful than they actually are, and they end up angering the people above them, or they're just pay no attention to the people below them, or don't give them, they're worried about their status, so they don't let that person below them, like, let this person shine. This person has a strength that I'm a little weak in this area. This person may be below me as far as title, but let them do their thing. Let them shine. McLeod, I've heard, is just great at that. That's one aspect. Obviously, in the end, you want results, and fans don't care about all those little things. But the people that work with them, like, if you're talking about being a leader and having a good staff and communicative and collaborative, he's really strong at that. And that goes a long way. I also think that when he did take risks, when there was no worry about, like, OK, we need college pitchers that can get to the big leagues faster because we have no pitchers. I mean, he did well. The one time that they really focused on that was the draft, where they took Steele, Cease, and Sands. Two out of three of the risk picks that they spent money on in later rounds. Was that that may have been the Schwarber draft?
Yeah. Using the Schwarber money. Yeah.
Yeah. So Cease is a hit. Steele, you know, took a little longer, but had TJ, and he looks like, at worst, he's a multi-inning solid reliever, and Sands is a miss, right? So you had, you took three guys that were high upside and hit on two of them. They just didn't do that enough, right? But they seem to be able to identify those guys, so it's unfortunate that they didn't do it enough, because it'd be really interesting to see that, and I think ultimately the player development side is what bit him. When we've gone over this over the years, but ultimately the player development changed so much, and they kind of stuck with what they trusted when things were changing at a level that it probably has never changed as far as player development goes, that rapidly and that drastically. It changed so much. They stuck with what they knew and what they trusted. And that was, I guess that's proving out to be a mistake right now. We'll see what happens 10 years from now, how much of this you need to, I think we need to strike the right balance too. We need to be careful to just say, like, well, all these, driveline trends are exactly right. And this is perfect. You know, you need to find the right balance of the old and new school. And some teams probably have a better idea of it than others, but, you know, it's not this perfect science still. Even as much as technology has helped things, I think you need to find a way to mix and match, so you're not, you know, we can just look at what the Cubs have done this past season and how many pitching injuries. Is that because of the pandemic? Is that because of new things that they're trying? Is that because they're being too cookie cutter with the new things they're trying and not being individualized enough? I don't know, but I'll just say that it's you can't just assume that this new direction is a perfect direction.
Sometimes we focus too much on the guys in polo shirts and khaki pants, but I think Dylan Cease is a worthy example of something that showed kind of when the Cubs got it right and where some of those gaps may be now. I mean, it took Keith Lockhart, an area scout who had played for the Braves, who's a parent in that kind of Atlanta area travel ball circuit, kind of getting to know Dylan Cease, kind of what it would take, getting some of the medical background and ultimately kind of convincing him to sign with the Cubs. That took money that was pulled out of the kind of Kyle Schwarber slot. It took pitching instruction. It took the strength and conditioning department to get him bigger and stronger and ultimately kind of marketed to a place where, not to go down the Jose Quintana rabbit hole, but you know, that you could trade him for a guy who would pitch in the NLCS for you. And, you know, Jason McLeod couldn't fix all of this. Whatever issues the Cubs have from here on out, it will not be because of his absence, but he had a lot of personality traits that helped connect lots of different departments and kind of got different people on the same page to Sahadev's point. He's someone who can talk to owners or minor league coaches, you know, very easily. And I think some of those elements have been lost around the Cubs, or at least kind of needs to be rewired to the point where if you do want to be the Dodgers, if you do want to be the Astros, you have to have your scouting, your medical, your R&D, your major league coaching staff, your ownership, all of it kind of working in sync. And I think it's pretty clear that the Cubs have not been at that point the last couple of years, and getting it back on track will be up to Jed Hoyer and some of these new voices he's brought into the Wrigley Field front office.
In a way, that's as old school as it gets, because it underscores the importance of just communication, just human to human communication in success. And I think I did like that. I can't remember where I read it. It may have been in some of your guys' fine work on the front office maneuvering, but I appreciated that for as much as Essen Bokhari is a math guy, data guy, research analytics, all of that, there's a heavy emphasis in his background on communication, on his ability to port the numbers, port the distillation of all of those inputs, not just the numbers, but like the nutrition stuff, the health and wellness stuff, all of that over to other humans, not just the players, but the coaches, and communicating about communication. How are we going to communicate this? How do we optimize them to get this information to people in the right ways? And I think without question, the Cubs have been thinking about that stuff for years. And so I'm not suggesting otherwise, but to see that be an emphasis is heartening, because I think that's probably I just have a gut feeling when it comes to physical health. You know, we're always talking in front offices, are always talking about how the next efficiency is keeping your guys healthy and being the organization that gets the most performance out of your guys, keeping them healthy. And you just wonder the relationship between that impetus and wanting to use all of that camera work and data and stuff for like pitcher mechanics. How do you manage those two courses, right? Because it might be one thing to be like, oh, here's what you need to be doing. You need to pronate more on this, blah, blah, blah. But you also have to communicate in a way that keeps those health goals in mind. And so I think, you know, getting all of that together and communicating it and managing it at an organizational level is part of what has made this era of player development so difficult. And so, and where you see so much stratification among organizations, the ones that do it very well, the ones that don't. I would bet dollars to donuts, you know, that virtually every organization has the data now. They have the cameras, they have all of that. It's the ability to combine that with so many other organizational directives and then port it over to players and performance on the field.
Yeah, I think it was Gabe Kapler that had a quote in one of those pieces written about their coaching staff and why things work,
the Giants,
and why they've been able to maximize. Yeah, why they've been able to maximize their talent. And basically, it's like, it's not like we have anything, any information that others don't. Everyone has the ability to get this information. It's how you relay it. It's how you use it. It's how you know, this isn't anything. I'm not breaking anything here, right? When I say that, it's like we should know this. You can have all the information that you can possibly gather, right? Every team should be able to get the information. It's how you use it. It's how you distribute it. And it's really like, are you able to, I mean, it's what you were saying, Brett, and that's like collaboration. Just because we talk about different departments, just because there's player development, R&D, amateur scouting, pro scouting, high performance, which is a huge thing now as well. all of those things, if they're not working together and in conjunction in some way, they may be, they're doing completely different things, but they need to be able to combine that stuff to get to the end goal of producing these elite players that they can perform at their best, right? And that's the really hard equation to figure out, how like how much of this and that and the other do you need to make it work, and how do you combine it all? And that's what, when we talk about connectors in a front office, that's what you really need: people that are able to communicate, people that aren't thinking, well, this guy's trying to take my job. You can't have any of that stuff, or someone that's just in it to get a promotion, right? You can't have that stuff. It's not going to work if that's your goal, unless your goal has to be like, how can we make this all work? How can we connect everything to make it work? And what's the right formula for this, for us to make it work?
All right. So that's where we'll leave it. And we will be back at you next week with On to Waveland, the podcast here about the Cubs. We'll also get into the World Series, which will have wrapped at that point, and thus will have kicked off another weird off season. I was going to be like, oh, it's going to be such a uniquely different offseason, but man, it's been like three in a row that have been, you know, oh well, this is why it's going to be so unique. So, you know, stay tuned. We'll get into why it's going to be a weird one this time around next week, but I think you already know, CBA, and we look forward to getting into all of those super exciting topics. I mean, it is fun. Changes in the CBA are fun to talk about. Rule changes, organizational structural changes. It's just that the pissing back and forth is coming, and I'm not looking forward to that at all. But until then, we hope you have a good rest of your week, and appreciate you listening and subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Brett Taylor. You can read my stuff at Bleacher Nation. That's Ahadev Sharma and Patrick Mooney. Get theirs at The Athletic, and we'll talk to you soon. Take care.